This is a Triple J podcast.
Every billionaire is a douchebag.
Parliament is a sick place.
I thought, oh my God, I might be an alcoholic. Obviously, I'm an inadequate guest.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Who's the Prime Minister?
What unusual efforts are you going to just to do your mandatory placement, your prac? How far are you travelling? Where are you staying? What are you going without? Would you consider camping? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Coming up later, you're going to hear some of the creative but very full-on ways some students are resorting to do their placements, including setting up camp.
I went and brought like a mini hot plate and some camp chairs, and that was basically like my survival kit was food, swag, a chair and a little table for like my laptop.
Yeah. Placement poverty hitting a lot of you hard, we're hearing loud and clear. If you can relate to this, tell me, what unusual or unrealistic thing are you having to do to make sure you can get your placement done, and what impact is that having on your life? Message in 0439757555. That is coming up later. Also ahead, we're going to get the latest on an inquiry into the government's proposed changes to the NDIS. First though.
Hack. Protesters have set fire to a bus in the centre of Belfast. Angry demonstrators have taken to the streets.
On Triple J.
Yeah, the scenes out of Northern Ireland's capital Belfast are shocking. Protests leading to cars, a bus, even houses set on fire. Locals saying they're afraid to leave home. What is going on? Well, the violence is linked to anti-immigrant protesters. And it's not just Belfast. There have been anti-immigration protests in other parts of the world recently. England, South Africa. In a bit, we're going to zoom out a bit with an expert. But first, here's Arianna Lucente with an update. And just a heads up, there are some distressing descriptions in here.
Across Belfast, Northern Ireland's capital, cars, a bus, even homes were set on fire, with people inside forced to leave.
My message today is one of calm.
Violence and anti-immigration protests broke out in pockets of Belfast after a knife attack a few days ago.
The victim was taken to hospital with significant injuries to his eyes and serious slash wound injuries to his back and face.
A video circulating online appears to show part of the attack unfolding on the street at night.
Some very distressing footage that was showed a man who's now been identified as a Sudanese national, who's around 30 years old, on top of another man, and he was essentially stabbing him in the neck. It was quite brutal footage.
The victim, a man in his 40s, has been taken to hospital. The video shows people trying to intervene, confronting the attacker until police arrived.
Last night's attack in North Belfast was horrific and shocking.
Northern Ireland First Minister Michelle O'Neill has called for calm.
Many people are feeling angry and many people are feeling deeply distressed, which is entirely understandable. Violence like this has no place in our community.
The incident caused public outrage, and a lot of the attention is focusing on the detail that the alleged attacker is Sudanese and claimed asylum. Far-right protesters have gathered in London too. And this is just a week after a different round of anti-immigration protests in the UK.
You got nothing coming, mate.
Earlier this month in Southampton, England, there were violent protests and people clashing with police. And it was sparked by the release of body cam footage showing the death of 18-year-old Henry Novak.
Sandy's been stabbed, so let's just check him.
Where do you think he's been stabbed? In the face? Oh, no, but we have to check, don't we?
Henry Novak's family have shown extraordinary dignity after their son's life was stolen in appalling circumstances.
The UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer addressed it in Parliament.
There are serious questions to answer, including how accusations of racism informed police thinking. And we're supporting the IOPC to get to the bottom of what happened.
Henry Novak, an 18-year-old white British student, was killed in December last year. He was stabbed to death by Vikram Digwa, a 23-year-old British Sikh man, now in jail for life for the murder, though he falsely claimed he had been racially abused and acted in self-defence. Nigel Farage is the leader of far-right party Reform UK.
It is now clear to growing millions in this country that we're living under two-tier policing. The instructions that are given to police officers from police bosses are clear and written down in ink. It says you must treat different ethnic groups in different ways.
The body cam footage showed Henry Novak handcuffed on the ground dying, and the police response is under scrutiny. South Africa has also seen a wave of anti-immigration sentiment. Here's South African President Cyril Ramaphosa.
We will and must not allow groups to use the legitimate concerns of South Africans to destabilize our country through inciting lawlessness and violence.
A series of recent marches called for illegal immigrants to leave by the end of June. And Mozambique say 5 citizens were killed in xenophobic attacks.
We will strengthen our immigration laws and policies. And finally, we will continue to engage other countries, including our sister countries on the African continent, to forge a broader response to migration challenges across our region and the continent.
Hack on Triple J.
Ariana Lucente reporting there, hearing from you on the text line, Rob saying sometimes the media validates these views and validates people to become emboldened. Well, look, let's look to see if there are any global trends here. Why are so many Western countries seeing this rise in anti-immigrant sentiment? With us is an expert, Sukhmani Khurana, an associate professor from UNSW, and her research looks at immigration and the media. Sukhmani, welcome to Hack.
Thank you for having me, Dave.
Obviously, we've seen these anti-immigration demonstrations take place in different parts of the world, whether that's Northern Ireland, other parts of the UK, South Africa. We've also had rallies against what's been called mass migration here in Australia too. A lot of these have been sparked by very specific local issues, but do you think there is a link with broader anti-immigrant sentiment in Western countries?
Look, I do think that there has been a long history of moral panic and economic crises generating anti-immigration sentiments, in some cases rallies, in some cases physical attacks. In the Australian context, for instance, your listeners would be surprised to hear that this dates back to about 1860, when you had the Lambing Flat riots in New South Wales when white miners attacked the Chinese miners. So this is not a new idea, the fact that local economic issues spark these sentiments. What is new, perhaps, is that the local issues vary in their severity. The immigration policies in these countries are slightly different. And that, mixed with social media algorithms, is what is a very, very potent mix and has made the spread of these sentiments particularly noteworthy and in some cases dangerous as well.
You're saying what has changed is the way this information is spreading and the way groups are able to mobilise and the speed in which we're seeing some of these protests. You've studied cycles of concern. Can you explain what that means?
What we're referring to is the fact that at particular times in a nation's history, like in South Africa, where I just came from, there the reason might be that there is a very high unemployment in Australia. It's not high unemployment, it's the housing crisis. So migrants are really easy to scapegoat in most of these situations.
So can Australia expect to see some more of what we're seeing overseas in terms of these protests here in this country as well?
I think what is important to remember is that Australia has a very, very controlled immigration policy. It's unlikely that we may have the same level of physical unrest, but I do think that in the Australian context, what is unique is that the economic justification for migrants doesn't seem to be enough to sort of stop this anti-immigration sentiment. So the government and the people from these communities and the media, the people who are doing the communication, do need to come up with other strategies to explain the underlying factors and assure people in general, because just saying that it's good for the economy doesn't seem to be sufficient anymore.
I mean, you've recently returned, as you said, from South Africa. You've also visited the UK as well, these places where there really is a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment at the moment. Did you feel tension when you were there?
In the UK, I would have to say that, again, the reasons are economic, but they're felt differently. In the UK, there's been a long sort of history of public infrastructure being very, very stretched. You know, people who've worked at the NHS or had anything to do with the NHS would testify to that. And there's similar concerns to Australia in terms of housing pressures. After Brexit, also about migration policies and they're trying to import some of our policies about how to deal with asylum seekers. So the pressure points might be slightly different, but there's also been a really long history of some of their mainstream media problematizing migrants and especially refugees in their context. And that mixed with the current social media algorithms and the rise of certain influencers feeding into the popularity of the Reform Party, which was unimaginable some time ago. So all of that has created some situation, a certain kind of socio-political economic situation in the UK that does mean that anti-immigration sentiment across the board is quite high, including from what I've seen in some migrant groups as well.
And as someone who has been studying the patterns and the media generally, do you feel like it could get a lot worse around the world, that we could see a lot more of this?
You know, since the election of Donald Trump, unfortunately, the second time round, the rhetoric around immigration and who is to blame for society's woes in the Western world, the blame has squarely fallen on migrants because it's an easy target. In many places like the US, the UK, it's also on people who are undocumented, who don't have the right to vote, who are therefore even easier to scapegoat. So I do think it needs to start somewhere. And there are sort of isolated cases of political leaders or media organizations that are trying to talk back to the rhetoric. You know, Zohran Mamdani in New York is quite popular with young people, with multicultural communities, with certain progressive communities. And he has become the mayor because people want to address that rhetoric. But that's a small place. And there's also something that we need to highlight, which is the harm that it causes to these communities. We don't have those figures in Australia yet, but I was listening to an academic based in Canada who studied this in the Canadian context, and she was saying that amongst international students, the rate of mental health harms and suicide has gone up, and the reporting of crimes against South Asians, which is the community that has been targeted there especially, is up by about 200% in a couple of years. So these are very tangible, measurable harms to communities. And I think they also need to be in the spotlight to understand why it can't continue.
Sukhmani Khurana, Associate Professor from UNSW, really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me, Dave.
And some messages coming from you on the text line. Someone's saying people have voted against mass migration for 20 years and have been ignored, that person saying on the text line. Another person saying these anti-immigrant protesters just want a scapegoat for why their life isn't going the way they want. We live in a sad and racist world, that person saying there. All right, we're going to move on.
Hack. The federal government says the reforms are needed to keep the NDIS sustainable.
On Triple J.
Yeah, there's still a lot of fallout from the government's recent announcement that it wants to overhaul the National Disability Insurance Scheme, or the NDIS as it's known. You might have heard that the changes are being investigated by a Senate inquiry that got underway this week, and there's already been some really concerning stuff heard at that inquiry. People warning that these proposed changes could push families into crisis, saying that they can't go ahead as they've been put forward by the government. Look, let's find out more now with the ABC's National Disability Affairs reporter, Naz Campanella. She's with us in studio. G'day, Naz. Thanks for coming on.
No worries.
Remind us, what are the changes that the government's trying to make here?
So, look, there's several changes that the government is trying to make. It is kind of the most dramatic changes to the National Disability Insurance Scheme. Really, the goal is to try and save around $38 billion over the next 4 years. And this legislation that is being analysed is a draft legislation that will pave the way for those changes to go through. So the bill entails several things like giving greater powers to the NDIS minister to make cuts to certain categories of funding within the NDIS. For example, a proposal to cut support to take people out of their house by 50%, support to something called capacity building, which is basically therapies, by 10%. Also placing way more expectations on parental responsibility. So basically looking at what is considered ordinary parental responsibility and whether the NDIS should be funding certain things or if parents should just be taking on that extra care. Some other things are around eligibility tests. So there will be a new functional capacity assessment that will be introduced, which will be used to analyse how and who gets entry to the scheme. And there will be a whole bunch of kids that will be moved off the scheme when Thriving Kids starts.
Yeah, and we've been hearing a lot from Hack listeners, whether they're directly affected or it's friends and family who are set to be affected. And a lot of them are really concerned. And we know this bill is pretty hefty as well. There's a lot to get into in these hearings in a short amount of time. I mean, let's get into some of the impacts we've been hearing about at this inquiry. What could the changes mean for parents of kids with disability?
Yeah, so this has been probably the most popular thing people are talking about in their evidence. So we've heard from advocates describing what parents are doing and how there's a lot they're doing that is not seen or understood. You know, it's managing the therapy appointments, not just booking them, not just getting their kids there, but actually then maintaining all of the paperwork that goes along with that, the paperwork and bureaucracy and navigating all of the NDIS, the Centrelink. Some of people have described that that is almost a full-time job. So in this legislation, there's going to be, I guess, a definition that looks at what is considered parental responsibility, and lots of advocates basically saying parents are in crisis and burnt out already as it is. And one final key thing, I guess, that came up around the parental responsibility stuff, Children and Young People with Disability Australia, the CEO, Skye Kokoski-Moore, talked about how she's really concerned that if people's supports are stripped away, the impact that that will have on families. And then when families do go to reach out for support, that they'll end up having to almost say that they need the support because they're not coping, and that could then trigger more interactions with the child protection system. And she fears that we'll be seeing even more of that.
You're listening to Hack. I'm Dave Marchese speaking with the ABC's National Disability Affairs reporter, Naz Campanella. We're talking about this Senate inquiry into the government's proposed changes to the NDIS. Naz, you've spoken about some of the impacts on parents. Have other things been brought up at the inquiry?
Yeah, particularly with this potential 50% cut to community and social participation. So that is a category of funding within the NDIS that allows people to have access to, for example, support workers to take them to doctor's appointments, therapy sessions. It could be going to do their groceries, getting out of the house, basically. Some people even use it to get to and from work. Now, if those supports are cut, in evidence over the last couple of days, we've heard that that will leave people isolated, in particular women, and it will lead to harm, including domestic and family violence. And the importance has been stressed about the need for people with disability to be seen outside the home. That is where they have general interactions with, you know, your person at the local coffee cart. And that, many people have said, is a form of safeguard in itself.
Okay, so what has the government had to say, Naz?
So the government says that the cost of the scheme has grown exponentially, far more than the Productivity Commission ever predicted. And so the government's basically saying, you know, there needs to just be more than kind of tackling fraud and non-compliance. It actually needs to be looking at the fundamental structure and design of the scheme itself. And it says that the NDIS will remain one of its biggest social programs outside of, for example, the aged pension, and that people with disability in Australia will continue to get the most comprehensive suite of services of anywhere in the world for disabled people, but that something does need to be done to make it sustainable well into the future for generations to come. It has also pointed out that it is looking at better supports for parents and their children as a matter of urgency. And it does say that this bill is compatible with human rights.
So when do we find out what comes out of this inquiry? Is that something we're expecting in the next few weeks?
Yeah, good question. It's going to wrap up pretty quickly. So people have had 2 weeks to put in a submission, to have their say, and it's had a pretty big response, I got to say. More than 4,000 written submissions have been submitted in that time. There's a 3-day inquiry now, so that wraps up tomorrow. And then this inquiry actually needs to report back next Tuesday, so the 16th of June. So it's a very quick turnaround. The disability community and advocates have been calling for the inquiry to be extended for more time. But at this stage, the government is pretty firm that it wants to get this legislation through Parliament really quickly. It currently doesn't have the support of the Coalition and Greens, and it obviously does need that. So it does look like changes are going to have to be made to it.
Yeah, well, one to watch for sure. sure. Thank you so much for keeping us across it. ABC National Disability Affairs reporter Naz Campanella, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.
And we've got a lot of messages coming through on this one. Someone saying, look, the growth of the NDIS is unsustainable and, you know, it's losing its social license if it continues to blow out. Another person saying, I work as a behaviour support practitioner under the NDIS and I know for a fact that the families that I support would not be able to cope without the amount of support they are given. So a few different opinions there. We're going to move on.
Hack.
But then I would get back to the campsite and it would just be like a cycle of euphoria and depression.
On Triple J.
Imagine this. You're studying at uni, you're looking forward to jumping into your chosen profession, whether it's nursing, teaching, occupational therapy, psychology. You just got to do that placement. The mandatory prac. The thing is, though, it's nowhere near where you live and there's no accommodation provided. So what do you do? Can you afford to put yourself up for a bit? Can your family help you out? Can you even do the prac at all? These are questions a lot of you are facing every day. Placement poverty, nothing new, but also it's not going anywhere. Even though the government has announced some changes in recent years, so many of you still saying you're struggling. The story's so full on. We're even hearing stories of people camping to getting their pracs, to be able to get their prac done. If this is you or if you're doing similar stuff, I'd love to hear from you. Tell me, what are you having to resort to get your mandatory placement done? 0439757555. Alice Angeloni's been looking into it.
When I initially found out about it, I was absolutely devastated because the locations that I did preference were places that I had already had accommodation lined up at.
Tani's 27 and a nursing student from New South Wales. And last month, she was allocated a two-week placement 6 hours from home.
We started looking at the caravan parks for like cabins and like hotel rooms and motel rooms and stuff like that. And the cheapest ones we could find was about $1,800 to $2,000 for the placement, which is just completely out of our budget.
She tried to change the location but says that wasn't possible. So she reckons the next best and only real option was camping.
It's like doomsday prepping, but for camping.
She borrowed a swag and packed for the trip.
I went and brought like a mini hot plate and some camp chairs, and that was basically like my survival kit. Was food, swag, a chair and a little table for like my laptop.
How was it trying to balance placement and camping?
So the first day I was full of hope. I was like, this is going to be great. Like, I like camping like as a hobby.
Tani says over the next few days, the reality of her situation sunk in.
It's 2 o'clock in the morning and it's just started raining and I don't know if this swag has been leatherproofed.
The sadness hit me. I was like, I just want to go home. Like, I don't think I can do it anymore. Which was contradicted by, you know, the daytime when I was at placement, I was having an actually, like, a great time while I was actually doing what I was supposed to be doing.
It's not just Tani.
I feel like so much of that is getting normalised now. And I'm like, it's not normal.
Gracie's 22 and a medical imaging student from Queensland. And she's found a creative way to tackle accommodation during placements by buying an old caravan.
So it only costs $300, but the catch is it's like it's just a shell, doesn't have wheels on it.
Gracie's in the process of doing it up and is hoping that it'll put her in good stead for the next few years.
Once I have this caravan set up, like it's mine, and then I can take it on like my next placement. So I'm sort of hoping to use it like all throughout uni.
But she says it shouldn't have to be like this. Last year, students in nursing, midwifery, teaching and social work became eligible for government payments to help support them during prac. It's currently $339 a week.
The payment is definitely making a difference for some students, and students who would otherwise have no income while in placement have a level of support, and that's really positive. And we've heard that the students who are getting that payment are actually able to afford food during that period.
But Felix Hughes, who's president of the National Union of Students, says the payment doesn't go anywhere far enough.
It's not available for enough students. It's only in particular degrees. And the support that is available still isn't enough to cover the cost for some students.
And he argues students shouldn't need a financial safety net at home to make it through placement.
A student should be able to go to mandatory placements without having to go bankrupt, without having to go to your mum and dad and beg for money.
Earlier this year, the Health Students Alliance published a national placement poverty survey that found 42% of participants said they went hungry during placement. It's something Education Minister Jason Clare acknowledges. In a statement, he said this is the first time a government has provided financial support for placements, and also pointed to changes to youth allowance, rental assistance, and the 20% cut to student debt as ways their government has tried to address cost of living for students. Back with Tani, she's eligible for that payment, but a few weeks on and she's still trying to get it approved. And as for camping, well, things got worse before they got better.
The bases of my lungs started to like ache. I brought it up to my student placement facilitator and she's like, you're going to get pneumonia. She's like, you've been wet.
Tani says she was helped into accommodation that's usually reserved for agency nurses. But she says ultimately the system is failing students.
I think a lot of students are falling in between the gaps. Like, I was lucky enough to have the resources to camp. A lot of other students don't even have that.
This is Hack on Triple J.
Ali Angeloni reporting there, and we're hearing from you on the text line now. Someone saying, we felt we had no choice but to pay for a motel, cost a couple of grand. Yeah, big financial output for a lot of people to make their placement work. But as we're hearing, so many people just cannot afford that. I want to hear from some of you who have got in touch now. We've got Ryan on the line with us. Ryan, you're a vet student, right?
Yeah, correct.
And what was the impact on you of doing your placement? How much did you had to do? What did you have to resort to?
So initially I was subletting a flat off someone I knew, and then that sort of came to an end and I thought I'd find something else. And then I was, you know, couch surfing for a little bit. And it actually resulted a few nights where I actually had to sleep in with the inpatient at the vet clinic.
So you were sleeping, what, where the animals are treated?
Yeah, there was just like a little room off to the side. Initially, I'd sleep in with the dogs, but, well, not in with them, but there's a few little like breakout offices.
Yeah, wow.
Thankfully, the practice manager was kind enough to let me crash when times were tough, and yeah, it was pretty difficult, obviously, and hard to keep up the studies.
That's so hectic to hear about, Ryan. I mean, did you think that you wouldn't get through it at some points? Were you like, this is way too hard, like I can't keep this up?
Yeah, thankfully some of the staff, they were really, really understanding and would let me stay at their place when they heard about my situation.
Okay. I imagine it also would have put a bit of a stress on you when you're trying to just do your job and learn so much new stuff all the time. Ryan, thank you so much for getting in touch with us. We've also got Erin on the line with us. Erin, you're also a vet student. We're hearing from a lot of vet students, and I think maybe that's because there's so much placement that you've got to do. How many weeks of placement did you have to do, Erin?
Yeah, so I'm in my final year at the moment, and there is over 40 weeks of placement that we've had to do.
Wow.
And the final year is all clinical rotations, so different sort of clinic every few weeks.
Okay, that's a lot. I mean, how were you coping? And were you able to put yourself up? Was there a financial stress? What was your experience?
Yeah, so we don't get any funding at all. So all of our accommodation and travel is self-funded. There were weeks where I was doing 50 hours on placement in the vet clinic plus after hours call out.
Wow.
And then working 20 hours a week on top of that if I was still in town or at home. And then the weeks where I'm out of town, you just can't work. So it's been really tricky. I've had to get funding to pay my rent through Red Cross and the Women's Centre at times.
Oh, that sounds so tough, Erin. Like, I can only imagine, like, not just the financial toll, but the mental toll of having to deal with all of that. Thank you so much for speaking with us. We've got someone else on the line with us. Nell is coming to us from Mission Beach. Nell, you're an occupational therapy student, so you're in Far North Queensland. Where is your placement? Because it's a pretty far distance from where you live.
Yeah, so my upcoming placement is in Normanton, which is about an 8-hour drive from where I live.
Wow, 8 hours. Okay, so have you figured out how you're going to do it? Like, are you going to drive there, put yourself up?
So, because it's remote, I actually do get free accommodation.
Okay.
but I will have to travel there and cover all the costs myself. My car has broken, so I've just had to take out a car loan so that I don't spend all of my placement savings on a car.
That's a lot. And no doubt you're missing out on work and stuff while you're at your placement too.
Yeah, because it's full-time. It's 40 hours a week, the placement. And then because I'm leaving my hometown, I have to leave my job for 7 weeks while I'm there.
Yeah. Oh, no, I'm so sorry to hear that. But your story, sadly, is not unfamiliar. There are a lot of people on the text line now who are in very similar circumstances. All right, that's all for Hack for now.